Then there was the click in the little black tube. Then the tiny, windy humming sound, which is the sound of space falling away from you, and of infinity, and of absolute nothingness. Every night when I came into my room, I would look at the telephone. I would say to myself, "It's going to ring." Once even, I was sure that it had rung, for the tingle and stab of its ringing was in all my nerves. But it hadn't rung. I'd merely fallen asleep. Once I picked up the thing and held it to my ear, listening to the tiny humming sound, which is the sound of the various things I have already mentioned. Every night at the desk in the lobby, I asked if there had been any numbers left for me. Yes, sometimes there were numbers, but never the right number. Then I would go up to my room, where the telephone was, and the briefcase with the photostat and the affidavit from Memphis. I hadn't given that to the boss yet. I hadn't even told him about not giving it to him. I would give it to him. That was in the cards, but not yet. Not quite yet. After the telephone had rung. But it didn't ring. Instead, after about a week, one night as I turned the corner of the corridor, I saw a woman sitting on the bench down beyond my door. I fumbled for my key, inserted it in the lock, and was about to enter when I was aware that the woman stood beside me. I swung toward her. It was Anne Stanton. She'd made no sound on the deep carpet, not with her light foot. "You give me heart failure," I said, and swung the door wide and added, "Come in." "I thought you were so careful about my reputation," she said. "At least you claimed to be. Once." "I remember," I said, "but come in anyway." She walked into the room and stood in the middle of the floor with her back to me while I shut the door. I noticed that she had a brown manila envelope in her hand with her bag. Not turning to me, she stepped to the desk by the wall and flung down the envelope. "There it is," she said. "The photostats, I brought them back. But I would have brought back the originals if you'd trusted me with them."
"I know it," I said.
"It was awful," she said, still not turning to me. I went across to her and touched her shoulder. "I'm sorry," I said. "It was awful. You don't know."
I didn't know how awful. So I stood there just behind her and didn't dare to touch her again, even with the weight of my finger.
"You don't know," she said.
"No," I said, "I don't."
"It was awful."
Then she turned to put her wide eyes on me, and I had the impression of stumbling into a well.
"It was awful," she said. "I gave them to him, those things, and he read them, and then he just stood there. He didn't move, he didn't make a sound, and his face was white as a sheet, and I could hear him breathing. Then I touched him, and he looked at me a long time, and then he looked at me and said, "You." That was what he said. "You." Looking at me.
"God damn it," I said. "God damn it, what's he blaming you for? Why doesn't he blame Governor Stanton?"
"He does," she said. "Oh, he blames him. That's what's so awful, the way he blames him. His father, you remember, Jack?"
She reached out and laid her hand on my forearm.
"You remember our father, how he was, how he used to read to us, how he loved us, how he taught Adam, and how proud he was of him. How he took all that time to teach Adam himself. Oh, Jack, he sat there in front of the fire, and I was a little girl, and he would read to us, and I put my head against his knee. Oh, Jack, you remember?"
"I remember," I said.
"Yes," she said, "yes. And Mother was dead, and Father did all he could. He was so proud of Adam, and now Adam, and now..."
She released my arm and stepped back and lifted her hands, putting her fingers to her forehead in a distracted gesture.
"Oh, Jack, what have I done?" she whispered.
"You did what you thought you ought to do," I said firmly.
"Yes," she whispered. "Yes, that was it."
"It's done now," I said.
"Yes, it is done,"
she said out loud, and her jaw closed with an expression which suddenly made her look like Adam. The mouth firm and sealed, the skin drawn and tight on the flesh, and she lifted her head to stare the world down, and I felt like bursting into tears. if that had been my habit.
Yes, I said. It's done. He'll do it, she said.
And I almost demanded, what, do what? For the moment I had forgotten the reason that I had told Anne the facts, the reason that I had given her the photostats, the reason that she had shown them to her brother. I'd forgotten that there was a reason, but I remembered now and questioned.
You persuaded him?
No.
She shook her head slowly. No, I didn't say anything. I gave those things to him. He knew.
What happened?
What I told you. He looked at me hard and said, you. Just like that. Then I said, Adam, don't say it that way. You mustn't, Adam, you mustn't. And he said, why? And I said, because I love you, because I love him, love Father. And he kept on looking at me, then said, love him. Then, damn his soul to hell. I called out, Adam, Adam. But he turned his back on me and walked across the room to his bedroom door and went in and shut the door. Then I went out and walked by myself in the dark for a long time, so I could sleep. For 3 days I didn't hear from him. Then he asked me to come to see him. I went and he gave me back those things. She pointed to the manila envelope. He told me to tell you that he would do it. To arrange it, that was all.
That was a good deal, I said.
Yes,
she said and moved past me toward the door. She put her hand to the knob, turned it, and drew the door ajar. She looked back at me and said,
yes, it was a good deal,
and went out. But she stood with her hand on the door jamb.
One thing,
she said.
What? I asked. A favor, she said, to me. Before you ever use those things, those papers, show them to Judge Irwin. Give him a chance, at least a chance.
I agreed to that. The big black Cadillac, the hood glistening dully under the street lamps, as I could see even from the back seat, eased down the street, making its expensive whisper under the boughs which had new leaves on them, for it was early April now. Then we got to a street where there were not any nice trees arching over. Here, I said, that place on the right, just beyond the grocery. Sugar Boy put the Cadillac up to the curb, like a mother laying little Precious down with a last kiss. Then he ran around to open the door for the boss, but the boss was already on the curb. I uncoiled myself and stood beside him. This is the joint, I remarked and started in, for we were going to see Adam Stanton. When I told the boss that Adam Stanton would take the job and that he had sent me a message to arrange things, the boss had said, well. Then he'd looked at me from toe to crown and said, you must be Svengali. Yeah, I had said, I'm Svengali. I want to see him, the boss had said. I'll try to get him up here. Get him up here, the boss had said. I'll go there. Hell, he's doing me a favor. Well, you're the governor, aren't you? You're damn right I am, the boss had said. But he's Doc Stanton. When do we go? I'd told him that it would have to be at night, that you never could catch him except at night. So here we were, at night, entering the door of the crummy apartment house, climbing the dark stairs, stumbling over the kiddie car, inhaling the odor of cabbage and diapers. He sure picked himself a place to live, the boss said. Yeah, I agreed, and lots of folks can't figure out why. I reckon I can, the boss said. And as I wondered whether he could or not, we reached the door and I knocked, entered, and confronted the level eyes of Adam Stanton. For a half moment, while Sugar Boy was easing in and I was shutting the door, Adam and the boss simply took each other in without a word. Then I turned and said, Governor Stark, this is Dr. Stanton. The boss took a step forward and put out his right hand. Perhaps I imagined it, but I thought I noticed a shade of hesitation before Adam took it. And the boss must have noticed it, too, for when Adam did put out his hand, the boss, in the middle of the shake, before any other word had been spoken, grinned suddenly and said, "See, boy, it's not as bad as you thought. It won't kill you." Then, by God, Adam grinned, too. Then I said, "And this is Mr. O'Sheehan." and Sugar Boy lurched forward and put out one of his stubby arms with a hand hanging on the end of it like a stuffed glove, and twisted his face and began, I'm glad to know you, Adam said. Then I saw his glance pick up the bulge under Sugar Boy's left armpit. He turned to the boss. So this is one of your gunmen I've heard about, he said, definitely not grinning now. Hell, the boss said. Sugar Boy just carries out for fun. Sugar Boy's just a pal. Ain't anybody can drive a car like Sugar Boy. Sugar Boy was looking at him like a dog you've just scratched on the head. Adam stood there and didn't reply. For a second, I thought the deal was about to blow up. Then Adam said very formally, Won't you gentlemen have seats? We did. Sugar Boy sneaked one of his lumps of sugar out of the side pocket of his coat, put it in his mouth, and began to suck it, with his fey Irish cheeks drawn in and his eyes blurred with bliss. Adam waited, sitting straight up in his chair. The boss, leaning back in one of the overstuffed wrecks, didn't seem to be in any hurry, but he finally said, Well, Doc, what do you think of it?
Of what? Adam demanded.
Of my hospital.
I think it will do the people of the state some good, he said, then added, and get you some votes.
You can forget about the vote side of it, the boss said. There are lots of ways to get votes, son.
So I understand, Adam said.
Then he handed the boss another big chunk of silence to admire. The boss admired it a while, then said, Yeah, it'll do some good, but not too much unless you take over.
I won't stand any interference, Adam said and bit the sentence off.
Don't worry, the boss laughed. I might fire you, boy, but I won't interfere.
If that is a threat, Adam said, and the pale blue blaze flickered up in his eyes, you have wasted your time by coming here. You know my opinions of this administration. They've been no secret, and they will be no secret in the future. You understand that?
Doc, the boss said, Doc, you just don't understand politics. I'll be frank with you. I could run this state and 10 more like it with you howling on every street corner like a hound with a sore tail. No offense, but you just don't understand.
I understand some things, Adam said grimly, and the jaw set.
And some you don't, just like I don't. But one thing I understand, and you don't, is what makes the mayor go. I can make the mayor go. And one more thing, now we're taking down our hair.
Then the boss suddenly stopped, cocked his head, leered at Adam, then demanded, Or are we? You said there was one more thing, Adam replied, ignoring the question, sitting straight in his chair.
Yeah, one more thing, but look here, Doc. You know Hugh Miller?
Yes, Adam said. Yes, I know him.
Well, he was in with me, yeah, Attorney General, and he resigned, and you know why?
But he went on without waiting for the answer.
He resigned because he wanted to keep his little hands clean. He wanted the bricks, but he just didn't know somebody has to paddle in the mud to make them. He was like somebody that just loves beefsteak, but just can't bear to go to a slaughter pen because there are some bad, rough men down there who aren't animal lovers and who ought to be reported to the SPCA. Well, he resigned.
I watched Adam's face. It was white and stony as though carved out of some slick stone. He was like a man braced to hear what the jury foreman was going to say, or what the doctor was going to say. Adam must have seen a lot of faces like that in his time. He must have had to look into them and tell them what he had to tell.
Yeah, the boss said, he resigned. He was one of those guys wants everything and wants everything two ways at once. You know the kind, Doc?
He flicked a look over at Adam, like a man flicking a fly over by the willows in the trout stream. But there wasn't any strike.
Yeah, old Hugh. He never learned that you can't have everything. That you can have mighty little. And you never have anything you don't make. Just because he inherited a little money and the name Miller, he thought you could have everything. Yeah, and he wanted the one last damn thing you can't inherit, and you know what that is?
He stared at Adam's face.
What? Adam said after a long pause. Goodness.
Yep, just plain, simple goodness. Well, you can't inherit that from anybody. You gotta make it, Doc, if you want it. And you gotta make it out of badness. Badness. And you know why, Doc?
He raised his bulk up in the broken-down wreck of an overstuffed chair he was in and leaned forward, his hands on his knees, his elbows cocked out, his head out-thrust and the hair coming down to his eyes, and stared into Adam's face.
"Out of badness," he repeated. "And you know why? Because there isn't anything else to make it out of."
Then, sinking back into the wreck, he asked softly, "Did you know that, Doc?" Adam didn't say a word. Then the boss asked, softer still, almost whispering, "Did you know that, Doc?" Adam wet his lips and said, "There is one question I should like to ask you. It's this. If, as you say, there is only the bad to start with, and the good must be made from the bad, then how do you ever know what the good is? How do you even recognize the good, assuming you have made it from the bad? Answer me that."
"Easy, Doc, easy," the boss said.
"Well, answer it."
"You just make it up as you go along."
"Make up what?"
"The good," the boss said. "What the hell else are we talking about? Good with a capital G."
"So you make it up as you go along?" Adam repeated gently.
"What the hell else you think folks been doing for a million years, Doc? When your great-great-grandpappy climbed down out of the tree, he didn't have any more notion of good or bad or right and wrong than the hoot owl that stayed up in the tree. Well, he climbed down and he began to make good up as he went along. He made up what he needed to do business, Doc. And what he made up and got everybody to mirate on as good and right was always just a couple of jumps behind what he needed to do business on. That's why things change, Doc, because what folks claim is right is always just a couple of jumps short of what they need to do business. Now, an individual, one fella, he'll stop doing business because he's got a notion of what's right and he's a hero. But folks in general, which is society, Doc, is never going to stop doing business. Society is just going to cook up a new notion of what is right. Society is sure not ever going to commit suicide, at least not that way and of a purpose. And that's a fact now, ain't it?"
"It is," Adam said.
"You're damn right it is, Doc. And right is a lid you put on something, and some of the things under the lid look just like some of the things not under the lid. And there never was any notion of what was right if you put it down on folks in general that a lot of them didn't start squalling because they just couldn't do any human business under that kind of right. Hell, look at when folks couldn't get a divorce. Look at all the good women got beat and the good men got nagged and couldn't do any human damn thing about it. Then all of a sudden a divorce got to be right. What next, you don't know, nor me. But I do know this."
He stopped, leaned forward again, and elbows again cocked out.
"What?" Adam demanded. "This. I'm not denying there's got to be a notion of right to get business done, but by God, any particular notion at any particular time will sooner or later get to be just like a stopper put tight in a bottle of water and thrown in a hot stove the way we kids used to do at school to hear the bang. The steam that blows the bottle and scares the teacher to wet her drawers is just a human business that's going to get done, and it'll blow anything you put it in if you seal it tight. But you put it in the right place and let it get out in a certain way, and it'll run a freight engine."
He sank back again into the chair, his eyelids sagging now, but the eyes watchful, and the hair down over his forehead like an ambush. Adam got up suddenly and walked across the room. He stopped in front of the dead fireplace with old ashes still in it and some half-burned paper, though spring was on us and there hadn't been any fire for a time. The window was up, and the night air came into the room with a smell different from the diaper and cabbage smell, a smell of damp grass and the leaves hanging down from the arched trees in the dark, a smell that definitely did not belong there in that room. And all of a sudden I remembered once how into a room where I was sitting one night a big, pale, apple-green moth big as a bull bat and soft and silent as a dream. A Luna moth, the name is, and it's a wonderful name, came flying in. Somebody had left the screen door open, and the moth drifted in over the tables and chairs like a big, pale green, silky, live leaf, drifting and dancing along without any word under the electric light where a Luna moth certainly did not belong. The night air coming into the room now was like that. Adam leaned an elbow on the wooden mantelpiece where you could write your name in the dust, and the books were stacked and the old dregs-crusted coffee cup sat. He stood there as though he were all by himself. The boss was watching him. "Yeah," the boss said, watchful. "It'll run a freight engine, and..." But Adam broke in. "What are you trying to convince me of?" "You don't have to convince me of anything. I've told you I'd take the job, that's all." He glared at the bulky man in the big chair and said, "That's all, and my reasons are my own." The boss gave a slow smile, shifted his weight in the chair, and said, "Yeah, your reasons are your own, Doc. But I just thought you might want to know something about mine, since we're going to do business together." "I am going to run the hospital," Adam said, and added with a curling lip, "if you call that doing business together." The boss laughed out loud. Then he got up from the chair. "Doc," he said, "just don't you worry. I'll keep your little mitts clean. I'll keep you clean all over, Doc. I'll put you in that beautiful, antiseptic, sterile, $6 million hospital and wrap you in cellophane, untouched by human hands." He stepped to Adam and slapped him on the shoulder. "Don't you worry, Doc," he said. "I can take care of myself," Adam affirmed and looked down at the hand on his shoulder. "Sure you can, Doc," the boss said. He removed his hand from the shoulder. Then his tone changed, suddenly businesslike and calm. "You'll no doubt want to see all the plans which have been drawn up. They're subject to your revision after you consult with the architects. Mr. Todd of Todd and Waters will come to see you about it, and you can start picking your staff. It's all your baby." He turned away and picked up his hat from the piano top. He swung back toward Adam and gave him a summarizing look from top to toe and back. "You're a great boy, Doc," he said, "and don't let 'em tell you different." Then he wheeled to the door and went out before Adam could say a word, if there was any word he had to say. Sugar Boy and I followed. We didn't stop to say good night and thanks for the hospitality. That just didn't seem to be in the cards. At the door, however, I looked back and said, "So long, boy." But Adam didn't answer. Down in the street, the boss hesitated on the curb, beside the car. Then he said, "Y'all go on, I'm walking." He turned up the street toward town, past the crummy apartment house and the little grocery and the boarding houses and the shotgun bungalows. Just as I climbed in beside Sugar Boy, in the place the boss always took, I heard the burst of music from the apartment house. The window was open and the music was very loud. Adam was beating the hell out of that expensive piano and filling the night air with racket like Niagara Falls. We rolled down the street and passed the boss, who, walking along with his head down, didn't pay us any mind. We pulled on into one of the good streets with the trees arching overhead and the new leaves looking black against the sky, or pale, almost whitish, where the rays of a street lamp struck them. We were beyond the sound of Adam's music now. I lay back and closed my eyes and took the sway and dip of the car, which was soft and easy, and thought of the boss and Adam Stanton facing each other across that room. I'd never expected to see that, but it had happened. I had found the truth. I'd dug the truth up out of the ash pile, the garbage heap, the kitchen midden, the boneyard, and had sent that little piece of truth to Adam Stanton. I couldn't cut the truth to match his ideas. Well, he'd have to make his ideas match the truth. That's what all of us historical researchers believe. The truth shall make you free. So I lay back and thought of Adam and the truth, and of the boss and what he had said the truth was, the good was, the right was. And lying there, lulled in the Cadillac, I wondered if he believed what he had said. He had said that you have to make the good out of the bad because that's all you've got to make it out of. Well, he'd made some good out of some bad, the hospital. The Willie Stark Hospital, which was going to be there when Willie Stark was dead and gone, as Willie Stark had said. Now, if Willie Stark believed that you always had to make the good out of the bad, why did he get so excited when Tiny just wanted to make a logical little deal with the hospital contract? Why did he get so heated up just because Tiny's brand of bad might get mixed in the raw materials from which he was going to make some good? "Can't you understand?" the boss had demanded of me, grabbing my lapel. "Can't you understand either? I'm building that place, the best in the country, the best in the world, and a bugger like Tiny's not going to mess with it, and I'm going to call it the Willie Stark Hospital, and it'll be there a long time after I'm dead and gone, and you're dead and gone, and all those sons of bitches are dead and gone." That was scarcely consistent. It was not at all consistent. I'd have to ask the boss about it sometime. I had asked the boss about something else once. The night after the impeachment blew up, the night when the great crowd that had poured into town stood on the lawn of the Capitol, trampling the flower beds beneath the great frock-coated and buckskin-clad and sword-bearing bronze statues which were history. When out of the tall, dark doorway of the Capitol, under the blue glares of the spotlights, Willie Stark walked out to stand at the top of the high steps, heavy and slow-looking, blinking in the light. He stood there, the only person up there on the wide expanse of stone, seeming to be lonely and lost against the mass of stone which reared behind him, standing there blinking. The long chant of, "Willie, Willie, we want Willie," which had swelled up from the crowd, stopped as he came out. For an instant, as he waited, there wasn't a sound. Then suddenly there was the great roar from the crowd, without any words. It was a long time before he lifted his hand to stop it. Then the roar died away as though under the pressure of his slowly descending hand. Then he said, "They tried to ruin me, but they are ruined." And the roar came again and died away under the hand. He said, "They tried to ruin me because they did not like what I have done. Do you like what I've done?" The roar came and died. He said, "I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to build a hospital, the biggest and the finest money can buy. It'll belong to you. Any man or woman or child who's sick or in pain can go in those doors and know that all will be done that man can do. To heal sickness, to ease pain, free, not as charity, but as a right. It is your right. Do you hear? It is your right." The roar came. He said, "And it is your right that every child shall have a complete education, that no person aged and infirm shall want or beg for bread, that the man who produces something shall be able to carry it to market without miring to the hub, without toll, that no poor man's house or land shall be taxed, that the rich man and the great companies that draw wealth from this state shall pay this state a fair share, that you shall not be deprived of hope." The roar came. As it died away, Ann Stanton, who had her arm through mine and was pressed close by the weight of the crowd, asked, "Does he mean that, Jack? Really?" "He's done a great deal of it already," I said. "Yes," Adam Stanton said, and his lips curled back with the words, "yes, that's his bribe." I didn't answer, and I didn't know what my answer would have been. For Willie Stark, up there on the high steps, was saying, "I will do those things, so help me God. I shall live in your will and your right, and if any man tries to stop me in the fulfilling of that right and that will, I'll break him. I'll break him like that." He spread his arms far apart, shoulder high, and crashed the right fist into the left palm. "Like that I'll smite him. Hip and thigh, shin bone and neck bone, kidney punch, rabbit punch, uppercut and solar plexus, and I don't care what I hit him with or how." Then, in the midst of the roar, I leaned toward Ann's ear and yelled, "He damn well means that." I didn't know whether or not Ann heard me. She was watching the man up there on the steps who was leaning forward toward the crowd with bulging eyes, saying,
"I'll hit him! I'll hit him with that meat axe!"
Then he suddenly stretched his arms above his head, the coat sleeves drawn tight to expose the shirt sleeves, the hands spread and clutching. He screamed, "Give me that meat axe!" And the crowd roared. He brought both hands slowly down for silence. Then he said, "Your will is my strength." And after a moment of silence said, "Your need is my justice." Then, "That is all." He turned and walked slowly back into the tall doorway of the Capitol, into the darkness there, and disappeared. The roar was swelling and heaving in the air now, louder than ever, and I felt it inside of me, too, swelling like blood and victory. I stared into the darkness of the great doorway of the Capitol, where he had gone, while the roar kept on. Ann Stanton was tugging at my arm. She asked me, "Does he mean that, Jack?" "Hell," I said, and heard the savage tone in my own voice. "Hell, how the hell do I know?" Adam Stanton's lip curled, and he said, "Justice." He used that word. And suddenly, for the flicker of an instant, I hated Adam Stanton. I told them I had to go, which was true, and worked my way around through the edge of the crowd to the police cordon. There I went around to the back of the Capitol, where I joined the boss. Late that night, back at the mansion, after he had thrown Tiny and his rabble out of the study, I asked him the question. I asked, "Did you mean what you said?" Propped back on the big leather couch, he stared at me and demanded, "What?" "What you said," I replied, "tonight. You said your strength was their will. You said your justice was their need, all of that." He kept on staring at me, his eyes bulging, his stare grappling and probing into me. "You said that," I said. "God damn it," he exclaimed violently, still staring at me. "God damn it." He clenched his right fist and struck himself twice on the chest. "God damn it, there's something inside you. There's something inside you." He left the words hanging there. He turned his eyes from me and stared moodily into the fire. I didn't press my question. Well, that was how it had been when I asked him a question a long time back. Now I had a new question to ask him. If he believed that you had to make the good out of the bad because there wasn't anything else to make it out of, why did he stir up such a fuss about keeping Tiny's hands off the Willie Stark Hospital? There was another little question. One I would have to ask Ann Stanton. It had come to me that night down on the pier at the mist-streaked river when Ann said that she had gone up to Adam Stanton's apartment to talk to him about it, about the offer of the directorship of the Willie Stark Hospital. She had said that to me, and at the moment it had disturbed like an itch that comes when your hands are full and you can't scratch. I hadn't, in the press of the moment, defined what was disturbing, what was the question. I had simply pushed the whole pot to the back of the stove and left it to simmer. And there it simmered for weeks. But one day, all at once, it boiled over and I knew what the question was. How had Ann Stanton known about the hospital offer? One thing was a cinch. I hadn't told her. Perhaps Adam had told her. And then she'd gone up there to talk to him about it. So I went to see Adam, who was furiously deep in work, his usual practice in teaching and, in addition, the work on the hospital plans, who hadn't been able, he said, to touch the piano in almost a month, whose eyes fixed on me glacially out of a face now thin from sleeplessness, and who treated me with a courtesy too chromium-plated to be given to the friend of your youth. It took some doing on my part, in the face of that courtesy, to get my nerve up to ask him the question. But I finally asked it. I said, "Adam, that first time Ann came up to talk to you about the job, you know, the hospital, had you told—" And he said with a voice like a scalpel, "I don't want to discuss it." But I had to know, so I said, "Had you told her about the proposition?" "No," he said, "and I said I didn't want to discuss it." "Okay," I heard myself saying in a flat voice which wasn't quite my own. "Okay." He looked sharply at me, then rose from his chair and took a step toward me.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I'm sorry, Jack. I'm on edge."
He shook his head slightly, like a man trying to shake the fog of sleep out.
"Not been getting enough shut-eye," he said.
He took another step to me. I was leaning against the mantel, and looked into my face again and laid his hand on my arm, saying,
"I'm really sorry, Jack, talking that way, but I didn't tell Anne anything, and I'm sorry."
"Forget it," I said.
"I'll forget it,"
he agreed, smiling wintrily, tapping my arm.
"If you will."
"Sure," I said. "Sure, I'll forget it. Yeah, I'll forget it. It didn't amount to anything anyway. Who told her? I guess I told her myself. It just slipped my mind that—"
"I mean, forget about the way I acted,"
he corrected me, "blowing off the way I did."
"Oh," I said. "Oh, that. Sure, I'll forget it."
Then he was peering into my face with a question darkening his eyes. He didn't say anything for a moment, then—
"What did you want to know for?"
"Nothing," I replied, "nothing. Just idle curiosity. But I recollect now. I told her myself. Yeah, and I guess maybe I shouldn't. I didn't mean to get her into it. Just let it slip. I didn't mean to cause any ruckus. I didn't think—"
And all the while that cold, unloving part of the mind, that maiden aunt, that washroom mirror the drunk stares into, that still, small voice, that maggot in the cheese of your self-esteem, that commentator on the ether nightmare, that death's head of lipless rationality at your every feast, all that while that part of the mind was saying, "You're making it worse. Your lying is just making it worse. Can't you shut up, you blabbermouth?"
And Adam, with whitening face, was saying, "There wasn't any ruckus, as you call it." But I couldn't stop, as when your car comes to the glare ice over the brow of the hill and hits it before you can get on the brake, and you feel the beautiful free glide and spin of the skid and almost burst out laughing. It's so fine and free, like boyhood. I was saying, "Not any ruckus, exactly. Just, I'm sorry I sicked her on you. I didn't want to cause any trouble. It was just that—"
"I don't want to discuss it,"
he said, and the jaw snapped shut. And he swung from me and went to stand on the other side of the room, very stiff and military. So I took my leave, and the chromium-plated courtesy was so bright and cold that my "be seeing you, boy" stuck in my throat like old cornbread. But he hadn't told Ann Stanton, and I hadn't told her.
Who had told her?
And at that point I could see no answer except that there had been some loose talk, some leak, and the news had got around. I guess I took that answer, if I really took it, because it was the easiest answer for me to take. But I knew, deep down, that the boss wasn't given to loose talk except when he wanted to talk loose, and he would have known that one sure way to ruin the chance of ever getting Adam Stanton would be to let the gossip mill start grinding on the topic. I knew that all right, but my mind just closed up like a clam when that shadow came floating over. A clam has to live, hasn't it? But I did find out who had told Ann Stanton. It was a beautiful morning in middle May, and just that morning, at that hour, about 9:30, there was still some last touch of spring. By that time, you'd almost forgotten there had been a spring. A kind of milkiness in the air, and way off yonder, from my window, I could see a little white haze on the river, milky too. The season was like the fine, big-breasted daughter of some poor, spavined sharecropper, a girl popping her calico but still having a waist, with pink cheeks and bright eyes and just a little perspiration at the edge of her tow hair, which would be platinum blonde in some circles. But you see her and know that before long she'll be a bag of bone and gristle with a hag face like a rusted brush hook. But she looks good enough to scare you now, if you really look at her. And that morning the season still had that look and feel, even if you did know that by the end of June everything would be bone and gristle and hag face and a sweat-sticky sheet to wake up on and a taste in your mouth like old brass. But now the leaves on the trees hung down thick and fleshy and had not begun to curl yet. I could look down from my office window on the great boles and tufts and swollen globes of green which were the trees of the Capitol grounds, seen from the height of my window, and think of the deep inner maze of green in one of the big trees, and of the hollow, shadowy chambers near the trunk, where maybe a big cantankerous jay would be perched for a moment like a barbarous potentate staring with black, glittering, beady eyes into the green tangle. Then he would dive soundlessly off the bough and break through the green screen and be gone into the bright sunshine where suddenly he would be screaming his damned head off. I could look down and think of myself inside that hollow inner chamber, in the aqueous green light inside the great globe of the tree, and not even a jaybird in there with me now, for he had gone, and no chance of seeing anything beyond the green leaves, they were so thick, and no sound except way off the faint mumble of traffic like the ocean chewing its gums. It was a fine, peaceful, beautiful thought, and I took my eyes off the green below and lay back in my swivel chair, with my heels on the desk, and shut my eyes and thought of swooping down and bursting through the green to the sudden green quietness inside. I lay back with my eyes closed and listened to the electric fan, which was humming like a dream, and could almost feel the wonderful swoop and then the poise inside. It was a fine idea, if you had wings. Then I heard the racket outside in the reception room and opened my eyes. Somebody had slammed a door. Then I caught the horror of a passage, and Sadie Burke swung into my ken, making a great curve through my open door, and all in one motion, slamming it behind her and charging on in my direction. She stood in front of my desk and fought for air enough to say what she had to say. It was just like old times. I hadn't seen her worked up that much since the morning when she'd found out about the Nordic nymph who had skated her way into the boss's bed up in Chicago a long time back. That morning she had exploded out of the boss's door and had described a parabola into my office, with her black chopped-off hair wild and her face like a riddled plaster-of-Paris mask of Medusa, except for the hot, bituminous eyes, which were in full blaze with a bellows pumping the flame. Well, since that morning there had, no doubt, been plenty of occasions when Sadie and the boss had not seen exactly eye to eye. The boss had had everything from the Nordic nymph to the Household Hints columnist on the Chronicle in his life, and Sadie hadn't been exactly condoning, for Sadie did not have a condoning nature. But a peculiar accommodation had finally been reached. "Damn him," Sadie had said to me. "Let him have his sluts, let him have 'em. But he'll always come back to me. He knows he can't get along without me. He knows he can't." And she had added grimly, "And he better not try." So with her fury, and her goddams, and her satire, and her tongue-lashings, and she had a tongue like a cat-o'-nine-tails, and even with her rare bursts of dry-eyed grief, she seemed to take a kind of pleasure, wry and twisted enough, God knows, in watching the development of the pattern in each new old case, in watching the slut get bounced and the boss come back to stand before her, grinning and heavy and sure and patient, to take his tongue-lashing. A long time back, she herself had probably ceased to believe in the tongue-lashing or even to think what she was saying. The juicy epithets had long since lost their fine savor, and a strident, mechanical quality had crept into the rendering of the scene, like a stuck phonograph record or a chicken-hungry preacher getting over the doxology. The words came, but her mind wasn't on them. But it was different that fine May morning. It was like old times, all right, with her bosom heaving and the needle of the steam gauge pricking deep into the red on the dial. Then she blew the plug. "He's done it," she blew. "He's done it again, and I swear." "Done what?" I demanded, though I knew perfectly well what he had done. He had another slut. "He's two-timing me," she said. I lay back in my swivel chair and looked at her. The bright morning light was hitting her face square and without pity, but the eyes were magnificent. "The bastard," she said. "He's two-timing me." "Now, Sadie," I said, lying back in my chair and sighting at her over the toes of my shoes crossed on the desk, "we went into that arithmetic a long time back. He's not two-timing you, he's two-timing Lucy. He may be one-timing you or four-timing you, but it can't be two-timing." I was watching her eyes, and just saying that to see if it was possible to put a little more snap into them. It was. For she said, You, then words failed her. "Me what?" I defended myself. You and your high-toned friends. What do they know? What do they know about anything, and you've got to mix them in?" "What are you talking about?"
I may not be high-toned, and maybe I did live in a shack, but it hadn't been for me, he wouldn't be governor this minute, and he knows it, and she better not get gay. For high-toned or not, I'll show her. By God, I'll show her.
What the hell are you talking about?
You know what I'm talking about,
she affirmed and leaned over the desktop toward me, shaking her finger at me.
And you sit there and smile that way and think you're so high-toned. If you were a man, you'd get up and go in there and knock the hell out of him. I thought she was yours, or maybe he's fixed you up, too. Maybe he's fixed you up like he fixed up that doctor.
She leaned farther toward me.
Maybe he's making you director of a hospital. Yeah, what's he making you director of?
Under the flood of words and the savage finger and the snapping eyes, I jerked myself forward, dropped my feet to the floor with a crash, and lunged up to stand before her, while the blood pounded in my head to make me dizzy, as it does when you rise suddenly, and little red flecks danced before me, and the words kept on. Then the words stopped on her question.
"Are you saying,"
I began firmly, that... I had been about to pronounce the name of Anne Stanton, for the name itself had been quite clearly in my mind, as though spelled out on a billboard. But all at once the name stuck in my throat, and with surprise I discovered that I could not say it. So I continued, "That she... But Sadie Burke was looking straight into my mind, at least I had that feeling, and quick as a boxer she jabbed that name at me.
"Yeah, she, that Stanton girl, Anne Stanton."
I looked at Sadie in the face for a moment and felt so sorry for her I could cry. That was what surprised me. I felt so sorry for Sadie. Then I didn't feel anything. I didn't even feel sorry for myself. I felt as wooden Indian, and I remember being surprised to discover that my legs worked perfectly, even if they were wooden, and were walking directly toward the hat rack where my right arm, even if it was wooden, reached out to pick up the old Panama which hung there and put it on my head, and my legs then walked straight out the door and across the long reception room over the carpet which was deep and soft as the turf of a shaven lawn in spring, and walked on out the door across the ringing marble slabs, and out into a world which seemed bigger than it had ever seemed before. It seemed forever down the length of white, sun-glittering concrete, which curled and swooped among the bronze statues and brilliant flower beds shaped like stars and crescents, and forever across the green lawn to the great swollen bulbs of green which were the trees, and forever up into the sky, where the sun poured down billows and surges of heat like crystalline lava to engulf you. For the last breath of spring was gone now, and gone for good. The fine, big-breasted girl popping the calico, with the face like peaches and cream and the tiny, dewy drop of perspiration at the edge of the tow head of hair, she was gone for good, too. And everything from now on out was bone and gristle and the hag face like a rusty brush-hook, and green scum on the shrunk pool around which the exposed earth cracks and scales like a gray scab. It was a source of perpetual surprise to find how well the legs worked carrying me down the white concrete of the drive, and how even if it was forever down the drive and past the trees, I was finally past them and moving down the street as though sustained in a runner of crystal and lava. I looked with the greatest curiosity at the faces which I saw, but found nothing beautiful or remarkable in them, and was not assured of their reality. For it takes the greatest effort to believe in their reality, and to believe in their reality you must believe in your own. But to believe in your own you must believe in theirs. But to believe in theirs you must believe in your own. 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, like feet marching. But if you have no feet to march with, or if they're wooden. But I looked down at them and they were marching. 1-2, 1-2. They marched a long time. But at the end of forever they brought me to a door. Then the door opened, and there, with the cool, white, shadowy room behind her, wearing a pale blue, cool, crisp linen dress, her bare, white, long, small arms hanging straight down against the pale blue, was Anne Stanton. I knew that it was Anne Stanton, though I had not looked into her face. I had looked into the other faces, all the faces I had met. I had looked into them with the greatest frankness and curiosity. But now I did not look into hers. Then I looked into her face. She met my gaze quite steadily. I did not know anything, and I did not need to, for looking at me, she slowly nodded.
This ends Disc 11. All the King's Men, Disc 12.
Chapter 7. After my visit to Anne Stanton's apartment that morning in late May, I was out of town for a while, about 8 days. I left her apartment that morning and went down to the bank and drew out some money, and got my car out of the garage and packed a bag and was headed out. I was headed out down a long, bone-white road, straight as a string and smooth as glass and glittering and wavering in the heat and humming under the tires like a plucked nerve. I was doing 75, but I never seemed to catch up with the pool, which seemed to be over the road just this side of the horizon. Then, after a while, the sun was in my eyes, for I was driving west. So I pulled the sunscreen down and squinted and put the throttle to the floor, and kept on moving west. For west is where we all plan to go someday. It's where you go when the land gives out and the old field pines encroach. It's where you go when you get the letter saying, "Flee, all is discovered." It's where you go when you look down at the blade in your hand and see the blood on it. It's where you go when you're told that you are a bubble on the tide of empire. It's where you go when you hear that that's gold in them thar hills. It's where you go to grow up with the country. It's where you go to spend your old age. Or it's just where you go. It was just where I went. The second day I was in Texas. I was traveling through the part where the flat-footed, bilious, frog-sticker-toting Baptist biscuit-eaters live. Then I was traveling through the part where the crooked-legged, high-heeled, gun-wearing, spick-killing, callous-rumped Sons of the Range live and crowd the drugstore on Saturday night and then all go around the corner to see Episode 3 of Vengeance on Vinegar Creek, starring Gene Autry as Borax Pete. But over both parts, the sky was tall, hot brass by day and black velvet by night, and Coca-Cola is all a man needs to live on. Then I was traveling through New Mexico, which is a land of total and magnificent emptiness, with a little white filling station flung down on the sand like a sun-bleached cow skull by the trail, with far to the north a valiant remnant of the heroes of the Battle of Montmartre, in a last bivouac wearing huaraches and hammered silver and trying to strike up conversations with Hopis on street corners. Then Arizona, which is grandeur and slow, incredulous stare of sheep until you hit the Mojave. You cross the Mojave at night, and even at night your breath rasps your gullet as though you were a sword swallower who had got hold of a hacksaw blade by mistake. And in the darkness the hunched rock and towering cactus loom at you with the shapes of a visceral Freudian nightmare. Then California. Then Long Beach, which is the essence of California. I know because I've never seen any of California except Long Beach, and so I'm not distracted by competing claims. I was in Long Beach 36 hours and spent all of that time in a hotel room, except for 40 minutes in a barber shop off the lobby of the hotel. I had had a puncture in the morning and so didn't hit Long Beach till about evening. I drank a milkshake, bought a bottle of bourbon, and went up to my room. I hadn't had a drop the whole trip. I hadn't wanted a drop. I hadn't wanted anything except the hum of the motor and the lull of the car, and I had had that. But now I knew that if I didn't drink that bourbon, as soon as I shut my eyes to go to sleep, the whole hot and heaving continent would begin charging at me out of the dark. So I took some, took a bath, and then lay on the bed with my light off, watching the neon sign across the street flare on and off to the time of my heartbeat, and drinking out of the bottle, which between times I set on the floor by the bed. I got a good sleep out of it. I didn't wake up until noon the next day. Then I had breakfast sent up and a pile of newspapers, for it was Sunday. I read the papers, which proved that California was just like any place else, or wanted to think the same things about itself. And then I listened to the radio till the neon sign began to flare on and off again to the time of my heartbeat. And then I ordered up some food, ate it, and put myself to sleep again. The next morning I headed back. I was headed back and was no longer remembering the things which I had remembered coming out. For example, but I can't give you an example. It was not so much any one example, any one event, which I recollected, which was important, but the flow, the texture of the events, For meaning is never in the event, but in the motion through event. Otherwise, we could isolate an instant in the event and say that this is the event itself, the meaning. But we can't do that. For it's the motion which is important. And I was moving. I was moving west at 75 miles an hour through a blur of million-dollar landscape and heroic history, and I was moving back through time into my memory. They say the drowning man relives his life as he drowns. Well, I was not drowning in water, but I was drowning in west. I drowned westward through the hot brass days and black velvet nights. It took me 78 hours to drown, for my body to sink down to the very bottom of west and lie in the motionless ooze of history, naked on a hotel bed in Long Beach, California. To the hum and lull of the car, the past unrolled in my head like a film. It was like a showing of a family movie, the kind the advertisements tell you to keep so that you'll have a record of the day Susie took her first little toddle, and the day Johnny went off to kindergarten, and the day you went up Pike's Peak, and the day of the picnic on the old home farm, and the day you were made chief sales manager and bought your first Buick. The picture on the advertisement always shows a dignified, gray-haired, kindly old gent, the kind you find on the whiskey ad, or a gray-haired, kindly, sweet-faced old biddy, looking at the home movie and dreaming gently back over the years. Well, I was not gray-haired or dignified or kindly or sweet-faced, but I did have a showing of my home movie and dreamed gently back over the years. Therefore, if you have any home movies, I earnestly advise you to burn them and to be baptized to get born again. I dreamed gently back over the years, and the stocky man with the black coat and spectacles leaned over me as I sat with my colored crayons on the rug before the fire, and he held me the candy and said, "Just one bite now, for supper's almost ready." And the woman with the pale hair and the blue eyes and the famished cheeks leaned over me and kissed me goodnight and left the sweet smell in the dark after the light was out. And Judge Irwin leaned at me in the gray dawn light, saying, "You ought to have led that duck more, Jack. You got to lead a duck, son." And Count Cavelli sat straight in an expensive chair in the long white room and smiled from under his clipped black mustache, and in one hand, the smallish strong hand which could make a man wince at its clasp, held the glass and with the other stroked the big cat on his knee. And there was the young executive with his hair laid on his round skull like taffy, and Adam Stanton and I drifted in the yawl far out, while the white sails hung limp in the breathless air, and the sea was like hot glass, and the sun burned like a barn on the western horizon. And always there was Anne Stanton. Little girls wear white dresses with skirts that flare out to show their funny little knees, and they wear round-toed black patent leather slippers held by one-button strap, and their white socks are held up by a dab of soap, and their hair hangs down the back in a braid with a blue ribbon on it. That was Anne Stanton, and it was Sunday, and she was going to church to sit still as a mouse and rub her tongue tip pensively at the place where she had just lost the tooth. And little girls sit on hassocks and lean their cheeks pensively against the dear father's knee while his hand toys with the silken locks and his voice reads beautiful words. That was Anne Stanton. And little girls are fraidy cats and try the surf with one toe that first day in spring. And when the surf makes a surprising leap and splashes their thighs with the tingle and cold, they squeal and jump up and down on thin little legs like stilts. That was Anne Stanton. Little girls get a smudge of soot on the end of the nose when they roast wieners over the campfire, and you, for you are a big boy and do not get soot on your nose, point your finger and sing, dirty face, you're so dirty you are a disgrace. And then one day when you sing it, the little girl doesn't say a thing back the way she always had, but turns her big eyes on you out of the thin little smooth face, and her lips quiver an instant so that you think she might cry, even though she's too big for that now. And as the eyes keep fixed on you, the grin dries up on your face and you turn quickly away and pretend to be getting some more wood. That was Anne Stanton. All the bright days by the water with the gulls flashing high were Anne Stanton. But I didn't know it. And all the not bright days with the eaves dripping or the squall driving in from the sea and with the fire on the hearth were Anne Stanton, too. But I didn't know that either.
Then there came a time when the knights were Anne Stanton. But I knew that. That began the summer when I was 21 and Anne Stanton was 17. I was back from the university for vacation, and I was a grown man who had been around. I got back